Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observation Podcast. It is Thursday, January 24th, 2019. I'm your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Dave Hamilton. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Kelly. Thanks for having me on the show.
Also with me today, I have John Martellaro. Hi, John.
I am very happy to be here.
My friendly neighborhood robot is on again with me today. And part of the reason he's with me today is because we're going to talk about one of our favorite pieces of technology, the one that started it all, the Macintosh. Happy birthday, Macintosh. It's Mac's birthday. What a great day. Everyone say happy birthday. Hey.
Happy birthday, 35th, right?
35th today? Birthday. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Time flies.
To the Macintosh. Now, John, you had one.
Oh, yes. It was 1984. We were in the throes of Peelings 2 magazine.
Oh, my goodness.
In New Mexico, at Apple II. And we had Apple IIs all over the office. We had an office in the bank building. It was glorious. And we had Apple IIs at home. And I had multiple Apple IIs for reasons that are too complex to go into. But
because reasons.
CPM cards plugged into them to do stuff and print and 9-pin printers and daisy wheel printers and magazine production. And Apple gave us the word that they were coming out with this computer. And would we like to buy it for the magazine at a discount? And none of us could afford the full $2,500 plus sales tax, but the Apple gave us a sweet deal. And so everybody on the staff, there were four of us principals and some office staff, we all went out and bought this little Macintosh and sat it between. I had it sitting between my two Apple IIs and the den where we had the workplace. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a weird little machine because the Apple II was in the prime of its productivity. It was everything you wanted on a computer. We had all decked out. We had 64K of RAM. We had dual floppies, color displays, printers. And the little Mac just kind of sat there, you know, all by its lonesome little self with its tiny little keyboard and its tiny little display. Mm-hmm. And we kind of looked at it like it was some sort of alien animal crouched on the desk. But wow. The feeling I had was I looked at it and I went, you know, even though the Apple II is in its production prime and we live and breathe it, and this little machine is kind of weird and doesn't seem to be very useful. The overwhelming feeling we all had when we looked at it was we went, yep, this is the future.
Now, I did look this up, and just to give people an idea, that $2,500 computer in 1984 is about a $6,000 computer today.
Yeah, that was pretty steep.
To give a relative, I remember when it came out, like, much like today, it was a very familiar sounding conversation. Apple put out what? That's far too much money to pay for one of those.
It was so smart of Apple to offer us a significant discount. It was about 60% of retail.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's pretty good.
We all had a chance to have one and then write about it in the magazine. And that was smart of Apple.
Yeah. Now, January 22nd, 1984, a few days ago, was the Super Bowl ad. The 1984 ad.
35 years ago, just in case anyone's listening and paying close attention and wondering what year we're in.
Yes. So that was the first look most people got at that in order to be eligible for awards. They aired that commercial at like midnight in Idaho in December to make sure that it would be eligible for advertising things. But after that, most people saw it during the Super Bowl in 1984. And, you know, everybody remembers it, like the woman in the shorts that throws the hammer into the screen. It was directed by Ridley Scott. So that kicked off. That was most people's introduction. And if you weren't somebody in a particular line of work where you had a lot of exposure to an Apple II in the first place, you had no idea who this company was that was making this computer.
I guess that's true. Yeah.
The thing about that time was the emotional euphoria associated with computers. You know, nowadays we like our computers, we're productive with them, and we often have a sort of sinking feeling that we have to be very careful that they don't, that the guys on the other end of the line don't betray us or give us grief. But, you know, those were simpler times when all things were possible. There was no internet. There was just the gloriousness of the GUI interface and the Super Bowl commercial. And you kind of felt really kind of giddy about the whole situation. It was a different kind of feeling than I feel today.
I don't,
nostalgic.
I was an Apple II guy like you, John, and spent a lot of time on Apple IIs and was, relatively speaking, late to the Mac, in that I didn't get my first Mac until 1989. But when I saw that, I do remember seeing that ad. I mean, I was young. I was, well, 13 or 12 or something. But it didn't resonate with me at all at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, the Apple II is the right thing for, you know, for what I do. And we didn't own one at that point. We used one at, you know, I would use one at school or borrow one and bring it home or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, no, I don't, that's not that, it's too closed was sort of the feeling. And that mm-hmm. feeling stayed with me. I did a lot with the Apple II. We wound up getting an Apple IIc at home.
Oh, the 2C, I loved it so much.
It was a great machine. And
yes.
Then as I was preparing to graduate high school and go off to college, it was like, well, I want to get, you know, a serious computer. And for whatever reason, that's when it wasn't for whatever reason. I had talked to some people and had a friend. I think he was down in Nashville somewhere. It doesn't matter. He was a bulletin board friend, you know, from mm-hmm. The online days. And he was like, no, you're going to like the Mac. And I was like, okay. So I wound up getting an SE30. They were super expensive at the time.
The SE30 was also a great machine.
We had them at Lockheed Martin, and they were our workplace go-to machine for.
Yeah.
And we all had, early versions of Word on them.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, yeah. it was a 2X in a portable, you know, format.
Yeah.
Well, not portable, but transportable.
It has
format.
A little handle in the head, in the top.
It does.
So yeah, it's portable reasonably.
I love that thing. I wound up getting it. A friend of mine was going to Reed College at the time. He was just a year older than me, maybe two. And
just over there.
Just over there, near you. And he offered to get it for me with the education discount, which saved quite a bit. I mean, it was like $1,000 off the price. I think it was supposed to be 4,000 and change. And it was, I remember it being $33.99 and being very happy about that.
Yes.
He actually went on to work for Apple in Richard Crandall's group, John. And I know, you know, Crandall, they do.
Oh, I know Crandall. Yeah,
well,
Crandall's not with us anymore.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. But I think Jason's still
time up in Portland area.
Jason's still in Portland, I think, and in that group. So Reed College worked out for him. But that's actually another great little story about how Crandall's group got formed. But we'll save that for another day. But
what's Jason's last name?
I'll tell you offline. How does that sound?
Okay.
Yeah. He's a man with many last names, actually. But That machine I loved, and I had an SE30 for several years. It, you know, it was
such
was
a so good
could,
machine. Like overall,
you could do with it.
Yeah,
yeah. You could put a video card in it so that I had a second monitor, which was a color display. I was able to upgrade the RAM to a full 8 megs, where I thought, man, like I've got the world in my hands here. Mm.
I did that with an S. I had two of them. And one of them, the tube went out and scooped. I mean, this was recently, like right around the time years started with two. I ended up with two of them, and one of them, everything inside was completely functional, but the monitor didn't work. So I cannibalized its 4 meg of RAM and had an SE30 with 8 meg of RAM. And what I ended up doing with the other one was scooping out the rest of it. And it's sitting on my desk just over here. I can look to the left and there
it
is.
That's awesome.
And it's a fish tank now. So that's how I upgraded that one in particular.
SE30s. You had to be really careful. It wasn't just the SE30, although it was more susceptible to this.
Yes.
If you take it apart, you pull it. You have the long handled Torx T10 screwdriver, of course, that you have to pull the screws out with, and then you lift the top off. And the monitor, of course, is right there because it was a tube monitor. Mm-hmm. And there was a flat piece that sat against the back of that tube. Mm-hmm. And if you applied any pressure in the wrong way to that, it would crack the tube and you'd hear the gas let out. And I remember one day with a customer who wanted more RAM added to her SE30. And I said, look, I got to be really careful here because I need to tell you that this is a thing that happens some of the time, you know, probably 25% of the time. Mm-hmm. And there's not a whole lot we can do about it if we're trying to add RAM in, because you got to get underneath this thing. And sure enough, while we were in there, we heard I was like, crap.
That's the air flowing in because it's vacuum.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, it's not the air flowing out. That's right. It's the air flowing in. Sorry. Yes, that's right. Yeah, no, it's totally right. And that was the end of it. So we wound up actually getting her a power computing machine. I was in Austin at the time. I owned several power computing machines for a while until I came back to the Mac, as it were. But,
you know, you bring back memories for me. All of a sudden, I'm remembering the glories of the hard disk.
Yeah.
You know, on the Apple II, we wrestled with these 130K floppies, and then we went to the Mac, and we got 400K floppies. And then there came a time when you could have a 5 megabyte hard disk, and you thought you had, as you said before, Dave, you were in glory town. You had more memory and more disk space, and you never know what to do with
it. Well, my SE30,
like millions of sectors, you know.
I had added an 800K floppy, 3.5-inch floppy to my Apple IIc, and actually ran a bulletin board off of that and everything. I had the Unidisk. And of course, the SE30 came with that, but the SE30 also came with a hard drive inside. I got mine with a 40 meg hard drive because I couldn't imagine ever needing an 80 meg hard drive. Like, that's crazy talk.
What do you do with all that space?
I bought an Apple Mac 2, the flat mock box with the two side-by-side floppies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had a 90 megabyte hard disk in there.
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, looking back on that. But, you know, functionally, they did a lot of what we do today. We just do things that use a lot more RAM and resources. But that was the point of the Mac, right? Several years before the Mac was announced, even Steve Jobs was speaking at some small computer club or something, and he talked about, without telling us that it was only obvious in retrospect watching this video, but he talked about how, you know, could you imagine a time where a computer has more CPU power than it needs for the one operation that you have doing at any given point in time? And maybe, and I'm paraphrasing here, of course, maybe we could dedicate some of that horsepower in the computer to helping the user with the experience of using the computer. And like that in and of itself, I know it's so obvious right now that, you know, we have our computers, even when they're sitting idle, they're doing so much, right? But that was not how it was prior to the Mac. Your computer did one task at a time, and you programmed it and dealt with whatever interface experience it had. Mm-hmm. And then you would say go, and it would go, and you were locked out, and it was not there to help you. It was just the CPU was there to do, 100% of the CPU was dedicated to any given task, and it was only one at a time. Mm-hmm. And the Mac really was the first certainly mainstream computer that changed that. And again, it seems so obvious today, but watching that video, I remember watching it a couple of years ago. I'll see if I can find it, Kelly, so you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
But it was really kind of mind-blowing. It was like, oh, they had to think about that. Like, somebody had to have the idea that it's okay to dedicate some processing power away from, or to the user and away from the task at hand. That's not what computers were used for.
It's yeah.
A really different way of thinking. It's really, that whole think different thing started early on at Apple. They just didn't codify it until later. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So just to give people a little bit of perspective on the OG Mac, it had a 9-inch display. It was a CRT, a tube display.
512 by 384, something like that.
342. Yeah.
Okay.
512 by 342. And the resolution on an iPhone XS is First of all, the diagonal size is 5.8 inches, right? And the resolution is 1125 by 2436. So there you go.
There you go.
That's so many more pixels.
So many.
Yeah. And I, you know, they, somebody used to do like approximate, you know, some sort of measurement and show like, you know, like the original iPhone had more processing power than like a Quadra or something, you know, and they would compare like what the old 68K chips could do to what the current model of iPhone could do. And
Kelly, I have a thought for you though.
Well, I just thought it was interesting to see that horsepower carried around in my pocket as opposed to the way we used to have to carry around, you know, like the SE.
But I'm thinking back to the half a dozen or so guests I've had on Background Mode who talked to me about how they got started with a Macintosh in their university publishing department or the high school yearbook, and they were using Mac Write and printing out to a printer gloriously and launched their whole career and inspired them. I wonder how many people's future career in technology and science or engineering is launched by having an iPhone in their hands. Is there the same inspirational value? Even though the technology is awesome, whole careers were launched by Apple IIs and Macintoshes. Maybe half my guests on Background Mode can attribute their careers to using an Apple II or a Mac in the early days. Can we ever say that about an iPhone? Will we be able to?
Maybe.
Have done it?
Probably. I bet the answer is yes. Yeah. And it will certainly will be, yes.
I haven't met them yet, but they're probably...
I have.
Too young. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Think it through, John.
iPhone's more than 10 years old now.
No, yeah. with AppCamp for Girls, that's what we do, is we teach how to build an app on an iPhone. And I know at least two people who have gone all the way through the program who have gone on to continue to pursue programming actively or continue to pursue technology in an active fashion because we sat down and were able to give them that opportunity. So I know at least two people I can tell you about like that. So if they turn out to be amazing computer scientists, I will make sure to have you have them on the show.
All right.
And in the meantime, I want to tell you all about our sponsor. Our sponsor today is ExpressVPN. With all the news about online security breaches, as you all know, because we tell you about all of them here, it's hard not to worry about where data is going. And even just making a purchase or you check your mail real quick on the Starbucks Wi-Fi and somebody with less than savory intentions could end up coming for you. And you really want to make sure that that's not that even if people are coming for you, that you're not leaving that information out there for someone to easily access. And the way that you do that is you use a service like ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN has easy to use apps, so they run in the background. It's just one little click. You can run it on iOS, you can run it on macOS. They're very, very easy to use. You flip it on, and then when you're done, you click it back off again. It's super easy. Anonymizes your information and make sure that it's encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. So those are things that can help make you an easier target if somebody were looking to sniff some information and try to get at some of your stuff. And ExpressVPN prevents all that. It's the number one rated service by TechRadar. It comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it costs less than $7 a month. So if you're ever out on public Wi-Fi and you want to make sure nobody else knows that you are the one out on public Wi-Fi, the way you do that is with ExpressVPN. If you head over to expressvpn.com/TDO, that's ExpressVPN.com/TDO. You can get 3 months free with a 1-year package. And if you head over there again, that's ExpressVPN.com/TDO. And when we're done with the show, I will go talk to some people about going on Background Mode with John. But in the meantime, John, you have written up some stuff about Mojave, which is now your go-to operating system.
Yeah, it took me a while. I had to make sure I had a preservation of my workflow for my podcast, Background Mode.
Sure.
And I was just very busy, and I thought I was going to let things sort out, make sure that there weren't any problems. It would interfere with my workflow. So it wasn't until Christmas break that I got into Mojave. And so I've been on a kick. The first article I wrote a while back was an update on how Mojave has meshed with my 2013 Mac Pro. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the best operating system that's been on that machine since it shipped with Mavericks.
That's fascinating because that's one of that's one of the oldest machines that can run Mojave.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very good to hear. That's great.
Yeah. Huh? So I just want to underline that was the 2013, which means it's coming up on 6 years old.
Well,
hardware.
I acquired it in the spring of 14, so it's about 5 years old.
Yep.
Well, whenever it was manufactured, like it's still the 2013 specs. So if you had bought the first one off the line, it'd be coming up on 6 years old. And so 6 year old hardware running a current operating system. It's a thing I like to point out to people occasionally is that you do get a lot of life out of that hardware. So
it's a glorious little machine. It fits nicely behind my Hewlett Packard 34 inch display. And it's just great for a writer.
Because John likes to see through time.
But I've had endless grief with Yosemite and El Capitan, and it wasn't until Sierra that things started sorting out. And Sierra was pretty good, but then High Sierra 10.13.5 introduced some kernel panics and some more graphics lockups. And it was with some trepidation that I went to Mojave because 10.13.6 was very stable. And I think I had a 30-day uptime on High Sierra 10.13.6.
Mm-hmm.
So I installed Mojave, and right away I had this subjective feeling that it was really rock solid. I had experimented with the betas on my MacBook.
Okay.
And I really liked the feel of Mojave, but I was concerned about putting it on the Mac Pro. But as I describe in my article from January 22nd, I have no problems with it. It just rock solid. I can run a screensaver for the first time since Sierra. I can run a screensaver for more than a few hours without the graphics card locking up my machine.
You know, I saw somebody just the other day talking about how, I think it was the dictionary screensaver, all of a sudden started working again because they had just upgraded to Mojave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've had some reports from readers and on Twitter that they're having a similar feeling.
So I don't know what happened, but yay.
Well, what was concerning me was the additional restrictions and accessibility and the security aspects of Mojave that I thought might interfere with my workflow or create stability issues with the operating system did not happen, has not happened in the last month. I can run my screensavers. I can all my apps on my workflow. My podcasting apps work great. I can easily obtain, you know, 2-3 weeks of uptime. Haven't had a single crash, not a single glitch, not a single funny spinning cursor, not any kind of cosmetic issues, no kickups, none of the kind of little nagging issues that you run across with Mac as a Mac user. Yeah. Spontaneous reboots, auto logouts, which we've had in the past.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I've run into
nothing,
a few of those.
Nothing. It's just the most stable operating system I've used since... Well, Mavericks.
I have to agree. Yeah, Mojave's been really stable on all the machines I've run it on here too. It's so stable you can take it for granted.
Wow.
And certainly we run into problems at Mac Geek Gab. I mean, all we hear about are problems. Rarely does someone write in and say it's awesome. You know, thanks for doing what you do.
That's not how that works. You guys wouldn't have a show anymore.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Right. But you know, so we do hear about some issues that people are having, but there are no consistent issues other than with people who upgraded to High Sierra and therefore also perhaps unbeknownst to them migrated to APFS from HFS Plus with the file system.
Oh.
And now that that's been a thing for about a year, we're finding all kinds of people who have problems like stability issues, weird stuff, slowdowns, lags. And in 100% of the cases that we've experienced, the solution of clone the drive, reformat it fresh as APFS, not this migrated. Because if you take I'll finish the thought. So reformat it as APFS and then just restore the clone to it. So you don't lose any data.
Mm-hmm.
You might not even notice that anything has changed. There might be some preferences that freak out a little bit because the disk's ID has changed. But other than that, you know, you get all your stuff. And that has solved it for a lot of people. And if you look, you know, and this is getting geeky, but if you run diskutil list and look at the dig into the structure of that disk, the disks that are formatted straight as APFS look one way. And these disks that have been migrated from HFS Plus are still actually kind of HFS Plus disks.
Okay.
With this APFS container sort of stuffed inside it, which makes total sense. You know, it was done without losing data, so
right.
It had to so use core
good,
storage
but,
and containers.
Yeah.
Right. It's just a little more convoluted, and it's
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the only issue that we've seen with Mojave, but it's not a Mojave issue. It's a time issue, right? These drives just, yeah.
Well, see, I've heard some of that.
Dave, one of the readers of that Other World Computing blog that I linked to pointed out that he has not yet been able to get his USB super drive to work with Mojave.
Maybe
he made a comment that Apple engineers haven't been able to help.
Well,
I can see. Yeah, I can see
test
that.
I wanted. Have you had a chance to try a super drive on Mojave?
Not an Apple one. No, I mean I've used external, you know, external third party ones that I've had for years, and they work fine. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think you guys are talking me off the ledge here a little bit because I've been sticking to high C, but I had to ship my computer off because the drive in it failed, and when the drive failed, they sent it back. I had to send it off to the repair depot, and it came back with a shiny new drive in it that had High Sierra on it, whether I wanted it to or not. Because at the time, they said, do you want Mojave? I'm like, oh, heavens no. And because it was a few months ago, so I was like,
sure.
What are you kidding me? No. And so I was like, no, High Sierra is fine. And so when I got it back, the drive I got back was APFS. So I'm assuming it started that way, has always been that way. And so the hurdle that people are running into with Mojave is not one I will have now. So thanks for crashing hard drive. That's actually might have saved me some hassle later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because I would have migrated in place. So, yeah.
Of course. Of course you would have. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So maybe I know what I'm doing this weekend.
That's right.
Maybe I'll end up with a new operating system on Monday. I will have to let all of you know then. Until then, I want to thank both of you for being here today. Dave, thanks for coming on and talking to me about OG Max.
My pleasure. It's fun to occasionally take a moment and glance at memory lane. So thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, I think the last time you were on, we talked about Mac Observer's anniversary. So I'm going to have to start calling you Dave OG Hamilton or something.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm the other guy.
Yeah, the other guy. There you go. Also with me today, my friendly neighborhood robot, John Martellaro. Thank you, John.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was fun.
And you can check out John's articles about Mojave now that he's upgraded and everything has settled in and been very happy on his computer. You can find those over at MacObserver.com. You can find us at TMO Daily. You can email us at observations@MacObserver.com. I am your host, Kelly Gamon. I will talk to you tomorrow. And in the meantime, be excellent to each other.